48th Street assured him. Kindler's sole objective was to get his hands on Wachovia's mortgage book so that he could crack the tape, Wall Street speak for examining the mortgages individually. That was the only way he could really understand Wachovia's real value. This was no small undertaking. The tape contained $125 billion of loans, including all manner of bespoke adjustable rates, like pick-a-pay, which gave borrowers a variety of choices each month on how and even how much to pay. Among the options was a payment that covered only the interest on the loan. Morgan Stanley also insisted on seeing Wachovia's business plan, but Carroll balked at that request. "Our general counsel says it's a real problem," he said. Kindler, convinced that Wachovia was trying to hide something, called Morgan's general counsel, Gary Lynch, in a rage and told him to put the screws to his counterpart at Wachovia, Jane Sherburn. "It's a big legal issue," she explained. "We can't give over the data without disclosing it in the merger agreement, if we do the deal." Lynch, too, was starting to suspect a problem. Were Wachovia's numbers worse than anyone knew? He wondered to himself. "Well, we can't do the deal without seeing the data," he told her. Sherburn relented. Lloyd Blankfein, his top shirt button undone and tie slightly askew, looked at his computer screen and saw in dismay that his stock price had dropped 22% to $89.29. Blankfein, who up until now had resisted pushing back against short sellers, was becoming convinced that the pressure his stock was under was not an accident. He had just ended a call with Christopher Cox, in which he had told the SEC chairman, "This is getting to be intentional. You know, you may need to do something here." In his email inbox was another message from one of his traders, saying that J.P. Morgan was trying to steal his hedge fund clients by telling everyone that Goldman was going under. It was becoming a vicious circle. Blankfein had been hearing these rumors for the past 24 hours, but he had finally had enough. He was furious. The rumor-mongering, he felt, had gotten out of control, and he couldn't believe J.P. Morgan was trashing his firm to his own clients. He could feel himself becoming as anxious as Mac had sounded when they spoke the day before. He called Diamond. "We've got to talk," Blankfein began as he tried to calmly explain his problem. "I'm not saying you're doing it, but there are a lot of footprints here." "Well, people may be doing something that I don't know about," Diamond replied. "But they know what I've said, which is that we're not going after our competitors in the middle of all this." Blankfein, however, wasn't buying his explanation. "But, Jamie, if they're still doing it, you can't be telling them not to." Trying to get his point across, Blankfein, a movie buff, started doing his own rendition of A Few Good Men. "Did you order the code red? Did you say your guys would never do anything?" Diamond just listened patiently, eager not to get Blankfein even more wound up. "Jamie, the point is, I don't think you're telling them to do this, but if you wanted to stop them in your organization, you could scare them into not doing it," Blankfein said. Even in its panicked state, Goldman was still Goldman, and Diamond didn't want a war. Within half an hour, he had Steve Black and Bill Winters, co-chief executives of J.P. Morgan's investment bank, send out a company-wide email. "We do not want anyone at J.P. Morgan capitalizing on the irrational behavior that's going on in the market towards some of the U.S. broker-dealers. We are operating as business as usual, with Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs as counterparties. While they are both formidable competitors, during this period, we do not want anyone approaching their clients or employees in a predatory way. We want to do everything possible to remain supportive of their business and not do anything that would impact them negatively. We do not believe anyone has engaged in any inappropriate behavior, but we want to underscore how important it is to be constructive during this time. What is happening to the broker-dealer model is not rational and not good for J.P. Morgan, the global financial system, or the country." Around midday, Hank Paulson reviewed the latest term sheet that his staff had drafted overnight on the issue of dealing with toxic assets, hoping it would be acceptable to present to Congress. His inner circle had assembled in his office, pulling up chairs around a corner sofa. "It looks much better," he said, turning the pages. "It's very simple." He paused and scanned the bleary-eyed faces in the room. "I want to reiterate that we have to get this up to the Hill quickly," he said. "We need to keep this simple, very simple. And we have to do it in a way that we encourage banks and financial institutions to want to participate. We don't want to have punitive measures with this. This is about recapitalizing our banks and financial institutions setting a price for assets. There was just one more issue to deal with, perhaps the most important of all, the price tag. Well, the toxic asset program made sense in theory. For it actually to work, for it to be effective, Paulson knew they'd need to buy large swaths of toxic securities from the nation's largest banks. The cost was going to be enormous, and it would be perceived both within and outside of the Washington Beltway as another bailout. Paulson looked to Kashkari, who sat on the sofa to his left, for guidance. The key concern at that moment was whether spending so much money would require them to have to ask Congress to increase the debt ceiling, a political flashpoint that would require Congress to vote to raise the amount of debt the country could take on. It had just increased that amount to $10.615 trillion in July. As the group discussed the outlines of the proposed legislation, Kashkari's view was that they ought to try to skirt the issue entirely. I don't know if that's workable, not having a reference to the debt ceiling. Or why don't we just say it's not subject to a debt ceiling? You can't do that, Paulson pointed out, and then added, I don't want to go for the debt ceiling and fail. That's the issue. And then people start focusing on it. I did the analysis, Philip Swagel offered, reading from his notes. He had determined that they would need only $500 billion, but only if the situation didn't grow any worse. To Paulson, who thought of himself as fiscally conservative, the answer was obvious. Okay, so I think the responsible thing is to go for the debt ceiling, he said, instructing Kevin I. Frommer, Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs, whose job it was to work the Hill, to construct some new language. You can go after it, but you don't have to put it in this document, Frommer replied, resisting Paulson's request. We never go up and propose legislation to do the debt ceiling. We just simply arrive at the fact that we have to do it and literally tell Congress they have to do it. They do it because they're too scared not to do it. It's just a question of optics. They decided that, for the time being, they wouldn't mention the debt ceiling in the document itself, but would address it later, ideally when Congress had already bought into the plan and it was too late to make a change. Before wrapping up the meeting, Paulson raised one last problem. Wachovia, he said, might falter. He was getting back-channel messages from Kevin Warsh that the bank's finances were in much worse shape than they believed. Everyone understood the significance of his statement. After all, Bob Steele, their former colleague, was its CEO. If Wachovia fails, I'm going to be trotting up to Congress again, so I'm hoping it happens after January, he said to a roomful of laughs. Listen, Jamie just called me fishing around for something, Colm Kelleher told John Mack midday Thursday as he marched into his office. He said he was calling to see if he could be of help, Kelleher added. It was strange. James Gorman, the firm's co-president, had just reported receiving a similar call, Mack replied, and Geithner had phoned earlier to suggest that he talk to Diamond as a possible merger partner, too. It's clear that for him to be calling us, he wants to do a deal, Kelleher said. Jamie is always hanging around the hoop. You know, Jamie's saying, let's make friends with these guys before I eat them. Mack was irritated by these suggestions. He didn't particularly want to do a deal with Diamond, as he believed it would involve far too much overlap. But he decided to stop guessing what Diamond might be up to and ask him directly. Jamie, Geithner says I should call you, Mack said abruptly when he reached Diamond on the phone a few minutes later. Let's get this out in the open. Do you want to do a deal? No, I don't want to do a deal, Diamond said flatly, frustrated that this was the second call he had gotten that day from a competitor that was annoyed with him. Well, that's interesting, Mack retorted. You're calling my CFO and you're calling my president. Why would you do that? I was trying to be helpful, Diamond repeated. If you want to be helpful, then talk to me. I don't want you calling my guys, Mack said, hanging up the phone. The 50th floor of Goldman's fixed-income trading unit was in near meltdown by lunchtime on Thursday. No trading was taking place, and the traders themselves were glued to their terminals, staring at the GS ticker as the market continued its swoon. Goldman's stock dropped to $85.88, its lowest level in nearly 6 years, The Dow had fallen 150 points. "The market is trading under the assumption that every financial institution is going under," Michael Petrov, portfolio manager for Heartland Advisors, told Agence France-Presse that morning. "It's now emotional." John Winkelried, Goldman's co-president, had been walking the floors, trying to calm everyone's nerves. "We could raise $5 billion in an hour if we wanted to," he told a group of traders, as if to suggest nothing was amiss. But just then, at 1 o'clock p.m., the market, and Goldman's stock, suddenly turned around, with Goldman rising to $87 a share, and then $89. Traders raced through their screens trying to determine what had been responsible for the lift, and discovered that the Financial Services Authority in the UK had announced a 30-day ban on short-selling 29 financial stocks, including Goldman Sachs. It was exactly what Blankfein and Mack had tried to persuade the SEC's Christopher Cox to do. The squawk boxes on Goldman's trading floor soon crackled to attention. A young trader found a copy of the Star-Spangled Banner on the Internet and broadcast it over the speakers to commemorate the moment. About 36 traders stood up from their desks, placed their hands over their hearts, and sang aloud, accompanied by rounds of high fives and cheers. The market was turning around, and our flag was still there. 9 minutes later, word began to spread that Paulson, too, was working on something big. "Treasury, Fed, weighing wider plan to ease crisis," Schumer says. A Bloomberg headline read, buoying the market further. At exactly 3:01 p.m., the market took off. Traders all over Wall Street turned up the volume when Charlie Gasparino of CNBC reported what he was hearing from his sources on Wall Street. The federal government was preparing some sort of RTC-like plan that would get some or all of the toxic waste off the balance sheets of the banks and brokerages. Taking RTC as code for "everything's going to be all right," traders pushed stocks higher immediately. Between the time Gasparino began his report and the segment ended, the market jumped 108 points, a brief respite from the steady downward spiral. At the Treasury, Paulson and Kashkari had been on a conference call with Geithner and Bernanke for the past hour, trying to decide on a path of least political resistance for shoring up the banks. Bernanke, who seemed bothered by the plan, was arguing in favor of direct capital injections, a measure that had worked in other countries. Geithner, who had been railing about the need for decisive action, all of a sudden started talking about the possibility of opening up the Fed window to virtually any financial institution with any kind of assets. It would be a bold act that would likely be applauded by investors. "I don't understand. What do you mean?" Kashkari piped up. "If the Fed really wanted to interpret its authorities creatively, it could do all this without legislation?" Paulson shot Kashkari an angry look, as it was precisely what he had been hoping that Geithner might convince Bernanke to do, and thus save Paulson a trip to Congress. "We can't do that," Bernanke admonished Geithner. The call had to end quickly, because Paulson and Bernanke were scheduled to brief President Bush in the West Wing on their plan at 3:30 p.m., and Bernanke still needed to drive over from the Fed. As Paulson and Kashkari began the 3-minute walk across the parking lot to the White House, Paulson received a call from Nancy Pelosi. "Mr. Secretary," she announced sternly, "we would like to meet with you tomorrow morning because of some of the chaos we see in the markets." Knowing that he would need to start building congressional support for his plan as soon as possible, he replied, "Madam Speaker, it cannot wait until tomorrow morning. We have to come today." Upon reaching the Oval Office, the Treasury officials took their places on the pair of sofas in the middle of the room. Vice President Cheney, Josh Bolton, Bush's chief of staff, and Paulson's old friend from Goldman, and several other White House staffers soon joined them, along with Bernanke and Warsh. Paulson told Bush in no uncertain terms that the financial system was collapsing. "If we don't act boldly, Mr. President," he said, "we could be in a depression deeper than the Great Depression," an assessment with which Bernanke concurred. Bush was struggling to wrap his mind around the precise course of events. "How," he questioned, "did we get here?" Paulson disregarded the question, knowing that the answer would be way too long and lay in a heady mix of nearly a decade of overly lax regulation, some of which he had pushed for himself, overzealous bankers, and homeowners living beyond their means. Instead, He pressed ahead and told the president that he planned to seek at least $500 billion from Congress to buy toxic assets, explaining that he hoped the program would stabilize the system. He hastened to point out the political ramifications, suggesting that buying toxic assets was overall a more palatable option than buying stakes in banks themselves. Bush nodded in agreement, but still confounded by the $500 billion figure, asked, "Is that enough?" "It's a lot. It will make a difference," Paulson assured him. "Even if he did want to seek a higher number," Paulson told the president, "I don't think we can get more." They all knew it was going to be a highly politicized issue, but Paulson insisted, "We absolutely need to go to Congress. Treasury doesn't have the authority." For a moment, Paulson paused and then added, "In theory, Ben could always do it." Paulson, unexpectedly playing politics himself, appeared to be trying to see how far he could push Bernanke, who, as far as Paulson was concerned, had virtually unlimited powers as long as he was willing to use them. "Ben, you can do this?" President Bush asked, sensing an opportunity. Bernanke, however, did not appreciate being put on the spot and tried to sidestep the question. "That is really fiscal policy, not monetary policy," he said in his professorial tone. Bush understood. "We need to do what it takes to solve this problem," he agreed. But given his low approval ratings, he knew he could be of little help on the Hill. "You guys should go up," he told Paulson and Bernanke. The implication was clear. "You're on your own." But he insisted that the two men sell Congress on the idea quickly. As they left the White House, Kashkari turned to Paulson and remarked, "I couldn't believe the kind of pressure you were putting on Ben." Paulson just smiled. "Maybe Ben will get there." Lloyd Blankfein had not been mollified by the market's late turnaround, with Goldman's stock ending the day up at $108, which was still better from its low of $86.31. In his office were Gary Cohn, David Vinier, the firm's CFO, John Winkelried, the co-president, John Rogers, and David Solomon. He knew that until Morgan Stanley fell, Goldman was probably safe, though that was hardly a comfort. Gary Cohn had been on the phone earlier in the day with Kevin Warsh of the Federal Reserve, brainstorming a way to get in front of the financial tsunami. Warsh threw out the idea that perhaps Goldman should be looking at Wachovia, and also wondered aloud about a merger with Citigroup, a fit that could solve major problems for both parties. Goldman could get a huge deposit base, while Citigroup would acquire a management team that investors could support. Cohn had expressed his doubts about the suggestions. "It probably doesn't work because I could never buy their balance sheet," he explained, "and the social issues would be enormous." The expression "social issues" was yet another Wall Street code for who would run the firm. Goldman's management didn't exactly have high regard for Pandit and his team. "Don't worry about the social issues," Warsh told him. "We'll take care of them." That was a not-so-subtle hint that if a deal was struck, Pandit might be out of a job. But Blankfein wasn't particularly interested in either alternative. Rajan Cohen had been encouraging Goldman to think about transforming the firm into a regulated bank holding company, which J.P. Morgan and Citigroup were, giving them unlimited access to the Fed's discount window. It was the same idea that Cohen had unsuccessfully pressed Geithner to consider for Lehman Brothers over the summer, and while Geithner had turned that proposal down, Cohen had become convinced that he might now rule differently, given the grave state of the markets. The notion of becoming a bank holding company had arisen at Goldman from time to time over the years, most recently at their board summer meeting in Russia, where they had discussed the necessity of holding more deposits. Blankfein appreciated that Goldman's dependence on even a modicum of short-term financing made investors, in this highly charged environment, anxious, and that a deposit base provided a more stable source of capital. Blankfein had always resisted the idea, however, because it came with a hefty price tag in the form of increased regulatory oversight. But these were extraordinary circumstances, to say the least, and the CEO sensed that the world might be moving inexorably in that direction. Given that the bank already had temporary access to the Fed discount window, and that the Fed had literally placed several staffers inside Goldman to monitor the firm, Blankfein started to believe that the prospect of a little extra government regulation didn't seem particularly onerous. This is only going to work if you scare the shit out of them. That had been Jim Wilkinson's advice to Paulson before he and Bernanke left to meet with the congressional leadership at Nancy Pelosi's office that evening. By Wilkinson's reckoning, unless they could convince Congress that the world was literally going to come to an end, they would never receive approval for a $500 billion bailout package for Wall Street. Republicans would complain it was socialism. Democrats would carp about rescuing white-collar fat cats. At a burled wood table just off Pelosi's office, 24 congressmen gathered to meet with Paulson, Bernanke, and Christopher Cox, who had been invited more as a courtesy than anything else. Pelosi began the meeting by welcoming them and thanking them for coming on such short notice. Bernanke, who was known never to exaggerate, began by saying gravely, "I spent my career as an academic studying Great Depressions. I can tell you from history that if we don't act in a big way, you can expect another Great Depression, and this time it is going to be far, far worse." Senator Charles Schumer, sitting at the end of the table, noticeably gulped. Paulson, with a deep sense of intensity, went on to explain the mechanics of his proposal. The government would buy the toxic assets to get them off of the bank's books, which, in turn, would raise the value of the assets by establishing a price and make the banks healthier, which, in turn, would help the economy and, as Paulson repeatedly said, help Main Street. Barney Frank, sitting next to Bernanke, thought Paulson's reference to Main Street was a disingenuous ploy to line the pockets of Wall Street and provided no direct help for average Americans saddled with mortgages they can't afford, foisted on them by the big banks being rescued. "What about the homeowner?" he asked. "You aren't selling this plan to a Wall Street boardroom," he said derisively. "That's right," Christopher Dodd chimed in. Richard Shelby disapprovingly characterized the proposed program as a blank check. Paulson said he understood their concerns, but he continued to play his scare-the-shit-out-of-them card, insisting that it was absolutely necessary. "I don't want to think about what will happen if we don't do this." He said he hoped that Congress could pass the legislation within days and promised to get a full proposal to them literally within hours. "If it doesn't pass, then heaven help us all," Paulson said. Harry Reid, sitting across from Bernanke, looked at Paulson with a sense of bemusement about the prospect that Congress would pass a bill of this magnitude that quickly. "Do you know what you are asking me to do?" he said. "It takes me 48 hours to get the Republicans to agree to flush the toilets around here." Harry, Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, who was deeply frightened by Paulson and Bernanke's presentation, interjected, "I think we need to do this. We should try to do this, and we can do this." John Mack was still at his office in Times Square when Tom Nides, his chief of staff, told him the good news. His sources at the SEC had confirmed that the agency was preparing to finally put in place a ban on shorting financial stocks, affecting some 799 different companies. The measure would likely be announced the following morning. Rumors of the pending action were already moving on the wires. James Chanos, perhaps the best known of the short sellers, who had pulled his money from Morgan Stanley because of Mack's support for the ban, was already on the warpath. "While this is all politically pleasing to the regulatory powers that be, the fact of the matter is that there has been no evidence presented of short sellers circulating false market rumors to drive down the price of stocks," he said. That day, Morgan Stanley's stock had fallen 46%, only to turn around in the last hours of trading, ending up 3.7%, or 80 cents. Between word of the government's intervention and the short-selling ban, Mack was hoping that he'd finally have some breathing room. He knew, though, that beneath the surface the firm was hurting. Hedge funds continued to seek redemptions. Other banks were buying insurance against Morgan Stanley's going under, covering more than $1 billion. Within the past 2 days, Merrill Lynch had bought insurance covering $150 million in Morgan debt. Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, UBS, Alliance Bernstein, and Royal Bank of Canada had all made similar moves to protect themselves from a collapse. Mack knew that what the firm needed most was an investor to step up and take a big stake in the company to shore it up. "I don't know how this happened," he confided in Nides, searching himself. Morgan Stanley had been considered too conservative, and Mack pushed the firm to take on more risk at exactly the wrong moment. And now here they were, in the perfect storm, on the cusp of insolvency. Matt could think of only one investor who might be seriously interested in making a sizable investment in the firm: China Investment Corporation, China's first sovereign wealth fund. Wei-Sun Christensen, CEO of Morgan Stanley China. A 51-year-old dynamo with close relationships throughout the government, had initiated discussions with Gao Zhigeng, president of CIC, within the past 24 hours. She happened to be in Aspen at a conference with him hosted by Teddy Forstman, the leveraged buyout king who coined the phrase "barbarians at the gate" in the late 1980s, during the bidding war for RJR Nabisco. CIC already held a 9.9% stake in Morgan Stanley, and Gao indicated to Christensen that he'd be interested in buying up to 49% of the firm. Gao had a major incentive to keep Morgan Stanley alive. He had invested $5 billion in the firm in December 2007, which was now worth half that. Another one of his major investments, in Blackstone Group's IPO, was down more than 70%. If Morgan Stanley filed for bankruptcy, he might lose his job. Mack and Nides discussed the deal, and while neither man was particularly interested, given their choices, they knew it might prove to be the only solution. Gao, whom Mack had come to know as a fellow Duke trustee, was planning to fly to New York Friday night to meet with them. Earlier in the day, Mack had spoken with Paulson, who prided himself on his extensive Chinese contacts, trying to persuade him to make a call to the Chinese government to encourage them to pursue the deal. It was a tad unusual to ask the government to serve as a broker, but Mack was desperate. "The Chinese need to feel as if they are being invited in," Mack explained. Paulson said he'd work on it and see if President Bush would be willing to call China's president, Hu Jintao. "We need an independent Morgan Stanley," he affirmed. Nides, however, had a more cynical view of Paulson's desire to protect Morgan Stanley. "He'll keep us alive," Nides told Mack, "because if he doesn't, then Goldman will go." Chapter 18. Hoarse and a little haggard, Paulson made his way to the podium in the press room of the Treasury Building the morning of Friday, September 19, 2008, to formally announce and clarify what he had dubbed earlier that morning the Troubled Asset Relief Program, soon known as TARP, a vast series of guarantees and outright purchases of the illiquid assets that are weighing down our financial system and threatening our economy. He also announced an expansive plan to guarantee all money market funds in the nation for the next year, hoping that that move would keep investors from fleeing them. But he had already gotten an earful that morning about that effort from Sheila Bair, chairwoman of the FDIC, who had called, furious she wasn't consulted and anxious that the guarantee plan would backfire and investors would perversely start moving their money out of otherwise healthy banks and into the guaranteed money market funds. Paulson just shook his head. He couldn't win. As he stood in front of the press corps, he did his best to sell the centerpiece of his plan, the TARP. "The underlying weakness in our financial system today is the illiquid mortgage assets that have lost value as the housing correction has proceeded. These illiquid assets are choking off the flow of credit that is so vitally important to our economy," he explained, his tie slightly askew and looking paler and more tired than he ever had before. "When the financial system works as it should, money and capital flow to and from households and businesses to pay for home loans, school loans, and investments that create jobs. As illiquid mortgage assets block the system, the clogging of our financial markets has the potential to have significant effects on our financial system and our economy. I am convinced that this bold approach will cost American families far less than the alternative: a continuing series of financial institution failures and frozen credit markets unable to fund economic expansion," he asserted, clearly reading from his script, having never learned how to read from a teleprompter. Evidently confident that Washington had finally brought the financial crisis under control, between Paulson's TARP and Cox's ban on short sellers, the stock market had risen 300 points at the open and continued to hold its ground as Paulson spoke. Paulson had intentionally chosen not to mention how much the program would cost. After a briefing earlier that morning from Kashkari, he now feared that he might actually need more than the $500 billion he had mentioned to the president a day earlier. A great deal more. Back in his office after the speech, he met with Frommer and Kashkari and debated what the precise cost might be. What about $1 trillion? Kashkari said. We'll get killed, Paulson said grimly. No way, Frommer said, incredulous at the sum. Not going to happen. Impossible. Okay, Kashkari said. How about $700 billion? I don't know, Frommer said. That's better than $1 trillion. The numbers were, at best, guesstimates, and all three men knew it. The relevant figure would ultimately be the one that represented the most they could possibly ask from Congress without raising too many questions. Whatever that sum turned out to be, they knew they could count on Kashkari to perform some sort of mathematical voodoo to justify it. There's around $11 trillion of residential mortgages. There's around $3 trillion of commercial mortgages. That leads to $14 trillion. Roughly 5% of that is $700 billion. As he plucked numbers from thin air, even Kashkari laughed at the absurdity of it all. John Mack had been watching CNBC on Friday morning when he received a phone call from Lloyd Blankfein. Charlie Gasparino, still reveling in his scoop about the government's toxic asset program, was arguing that it meant that Morgan Stanley would no longer be forced to do a deal, or at least not have to move as quickly. Mack, laughing to himself, knew better. He had to get something accomplished by the weekend, or Morgan Stanley could well go the way of Lehman Brothers. What do you think of becoming a bank holding company? Blankfein asked Mack when he picked up the receiver. Mack hadn't really studied the issue and asked, would that help us? Blankfein said that Goldman had been investigating the possibility and explained to him the benefits, namely, that if they allowed themselves to be regulated by the Federal Reserve, they'd have unlimited access to the discount window and would have an easier time raising capital, among other things. Well, in the long run, it would really help us, Mack said. In the short run, however, I don't know if you can pull it off fast enough to help us. You have to hang on, Blankfein urged him, clearly still anxious about how punishing the markets had become, because I'm 30 seconds behind you. John Prusin, the Morgan Stanley banker who had been assigned to review Wachovia's $120 billion mortgage portfolio to crack the tape, finally had some answers. A team of Morgan bankers in New York, London, and Hong Kong had worked overnight to sift through as many mortgages as they humanly could. Now I know why they didn't want to give us the tape, Prusin announced dourly at a meeting before they headed over to Wachtell Lipton to begin diligence on Wachovia. It shows they're expecting a 19% cumulative loss. Just a week earlier, at a public presentation at Lehman's conference, Bob Steele had estimated that figure at 12%. In fairness, Prusin noted, the market had deteriorated markedly since then, and cumulative loss figures were inherently unreliable, because a bank could manipulate them up or down. Still, that big a discrepancy couldn't be explained away easily. At best, Prusin thought, Wachovia had been foolishly optimistic. You've got to be fucking kidding me, Scully exclaimed. We obviously can't do this deal. To make it work, Morgan Stanley would have to raise some $20 billion to $24 billion of equity to capitalize the combined firm, a virtual impossibility under the current market conditions. Even so, the Morgan bankers decided not to cancel the all-day diligence session, as they figured they had nothing to lose. Morgan Stanley might well be able to take advantage of Paulson's new plan to buy toxic assets from Wachovia, and, indeed, investors had already bid up Wachovia's shares that morning on precisely that expectation. 30 people each from Morgan Stanley and Wachovia showed up at Wachtell Lipton's 52nd offices. Wachovia, purposely not using Goldman Sachs as an advisor for this project given its rivalry with Morgan Stanley, brought a new set of advisors from Perella Weinberg Partners, Joe Perella, the legendary financier, and Peter Weinberg, a former Goldman banker who was the grandson of Sidney Weinberg, the Goldman patriarch. As Weinberg came to shake Kindler's hand, they could hardly believe they were even talking to each other under such dire circumstances. What happened? How the fuck did we get here? Weinberg asked aloud. God only knows. You can't make this shit up, Kindler said. Within the first 2 hours of their work, however, something began to feel wrong to the Morgan bankers. Paulson's TARP announcement had eased the climate of fear at Wachovia, which would likely be a huge beneficiary of the program because it could sell its most toxic assets to the government, and thus the urgency of rushing into a deal. Kindler became concerned that Wachovia was just buying time while the bank worked on another deal, probably with Goldman. Surveying the room, he announced to his colleagues, "Look at us, we're the B-team. This isn't going to happen." The Wachovia team, meanwhile, had its own doubts about Morgan Stanley's commitment. If this deal was so important to it, where were its top people? David Carroll, who was leading the Wachovia team, couldn't understand why Colm Kelleher, Morgan's CFO, was not involved. By 2 o'clock p.m., the Morgan Stanley team had withdrawn from Wachtell and gone back to Times Square to consult with Mack. "These guys are clearly disengaged," Kindler told him. Scully described Wachovia's mortgage book as a $40 to $50 billion problem. It's huge. The junior Wachovia team is not disputing our analysis. Kelleher, who had been keeping a careful watch over the firm's dwindling cash pile, had just taken a look at Wachovia's numbers for himself and observed, "That's a shit sandwich even I can't get my big mouth around." It became increasingly clear to everybody that the only way this deal was going to take place was if the government provided cover. Mack, not having heard anything that soothed his nerves, had his secretary get Steele on the line. "You called us and said you wanted to go 100 miles an hour, he reminded him, his southern manners starting to fray, "and I'm sensing from your team that there's not the same urgency." Steele was apologetic. "You're right," he told Mack. "We're not doing this for the next couple of days." They agreed they'd get back in touch, but before he hung up, Steele asked Mack for a favor. "It wouldn't be helpful if it leaked out that we're not talking," he said. Fortress Goldman. Tim Geithner had written those two words on a pad on his desk after a Friday afternoon conversation with Lloyd Blankfein, who must have uttered the phrase a dozen times. It was his way of saying he wanted Goldman to remain a standalone institution. Geithner had been concerned that Blankfein didn't appreciate how perilous his situation actually was, and had quizzed him about the firm's financial health. Blankfein had said he was hopeful that Goldman would weather the crisis, but had acknowledged, "It depends on what happens to the rest of the world." Geithner had also sounded Blankfein out about the bank holding company idea. While Blankfein was originally somewhat resistant, by now he had officially warmed up to it. He had become increasingly convinced that if the market knew that the Federal Reserve was behind him, it would instill confidence in investors. And after doing the math, by his estimate, 95% of Goldman's assets could already be pledged to the Fed's discount window. So another 5% didn't represent that big a hurdle. Rajan Cohen, Goldman's lawyer, had already discussed this with Geithner earlier in the day. Of course, he'd have to sell Bernanke on the idea. Blankfein, whose voice revealed to Geithner an almost panicked state, had also said that he was planning to raise capital and was certain that the firm would be able to do so from private investors. Maybe even Warren Buffett would be interested. The waiter at Blue Fin had just brought several massive plates of sushi, spicy lobster rolls, pieces of yellowtail tuna, and tobiko, when Colm Kelleher's cell phone rang. He had gone to get a late lunch with his Morgan Stanley colleagues, including James Gorman, Waleed Chama, and Tom Nides, and the group had been chatting about their plan to meet later that night with Gao Zhiqing of China Investment Corporation, who was bringing an entire team to New York. With Wachovia effectively out of the picture, the Chinese were now their sole prospect. When Kelleher looked down at the caller ID, he saw it was an international number in Japan and walked to the corner of the restaurant. Jonathan Kindred, president of Morgan Stanley's security business in Tokyo, greeted him and said excitedly, "This is interesting. I just got a call from Mitsubishi. They want to do the deal." Mitsubishi UFJ, Japan's biggest bank, was interested in buying a stake in Morgan Stanley. The call had come completely unexpectedly and totally unsolicited. Morgan Stanley's management had actually ruled out calling Mitsubishi earlier in the week after its chairman, Ryosuke Tamakoshi, said publicly at a conference that following Lehman's bankruptcy, his firm would not be making any investments in the United States. Kindred said he thought Mitsubishi was prepared to move quickly, but Kelleher, rolling his eyes, was skeptical. He had worked with other Japanese banks before, and in his experience, they had always lived up to their reputation as being slow, risk-averse, and deeply bureaucratic. James Gorman's eyes widened when Kelleher returned to the table with Kindred's news. This could be exactly what they needed, he thought. Kelleher only scoffed. This is a waste of time. They're never going to do anything. Colm, I really feel they're going to do something, Gorman insisted. When Gorman worked at Merrill Lynch, he had orchestrated a joint venture with Mitsubishi to combine their private banking and wealth management businesses in Japan. He thought that the fact that Mitsubishi had initiated the call to express interest was an encouraging sign. This stuff doesn't happen by accident, he said. Kevin Warsh, the Fed governor, had taken the U.S. Airways shuttle to New York late on Friday to help Geithner think through how to handle the upcoming weekend. Just as important, he would be Bernanke's eyes and ears on the ground. As he and his driver made their way through traffic from LaGuardia Airport to the New York Fed, he received a call from Rajan Cohen, who by now was advising both Wachovia on its talks with Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs on its bank holding company status. He told Warsh he had an idea, a potentially big one. It wasn't a plan officially sanctioned by his clients, just a friendly suggestion from an old-timer in the business. He suggested to Warsh that the government attempt a shotgun wedding between Goldman and Wachovia. He knew it was a long shot. The optics, he acknowledged, would be problematic, given Paulson's connection to Goldman. But it would solve everyone's problems. Goldman would get the deposit base it had been seeking, and Wachovia would have its death sentence stayed. Warsh listened to the proposal and, almost to his own surprise, liked it. Gaoji King, dressed in a sporty turtleneck and blazer, arrived at Morgan Stanley with his team just after 9 o'clock p.m., having flown into New York with Morgan Stanley's Waesun Christensen on a private jet from Aspen. He had been on a panel that afternoon with Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire, at Ted Forsman's gathering, and had asked the moderator, Charlie Rose, to make certain the session didn't run long so that he could reach the airport in time. Given the rumors in the newspapers, everyone at the panel knew exactly where he was headed. Gao's back was causing him so much pain that when James Gorman first went to introduce himself, he found Gao lying on the floor of a conference room on the 40th floor in the middle of a telephone call. Mac, ever the accommodating host, had a couch brought from the executive dining room for his guest to lie on. Over dinner, ordered in from Mac's favorite restaurant, San Pietro, again, they discussed a possible transaction. Alternating between standing up and lying down, Gao reiterated his interest in buying 49% of Morgan Stanley. As he had told Christensen on the flight over, he now indicated that he was prepared to provide the firm with a credit line of as much as $50 billion and a nominal equity investment, no more than $5 billion, maybe less. Mac was stunned. He had known the price that would be offered might be low, but to him this was absurdly so. It was effectively merely a loan. While it might help Morgan Stanley stay in business, Gao was clearly taking advantage of its weakened condition. To Gao, the offer presented a way to reset the price he had paid for the 10% stake he had acquired in Morgan Stanley in 2007, which was now worth far less. Unlike deals that other sovereign wealth funds had struck then, giving them the right to reset the value of the deal if the firms sold equity at a lower price later, CIC hadn't had the presence of mind to insist on that stipulation. For some inexplicable reason, Gao had convinced himself that the agreement did include such a provision, until Morgan Stanley got him a copy to show him that it didn't. However insulting Gao's proposal, Mac recognized that his situation was desperate. Despite the market rally, the firm had continued to bleed cash. Kelleher had given him the cash balances, and they were not good. About $40 billion in the tank. A few bad days could wipe them out, and most days lately had been bad ones. Without many other options, Mac told Gao the firm would open its books to him. Gao had hired Sullivan and Cromwell's seemingly omnipresent lawyer, Rajid Cohen, as well as Deutsche Bank, to advise him, and both companies were already sending over teams to assist the Chinese. A sheet of paper marked CIC was affixed to the conference room door that would become Gao's temporary office. Mac also had a physical therapist summoned to work on his bad back. When Mac returned to his office and huddled with Christensen and his team, they were flabbergasted. Chama initially thought he had misheard Christensen when she presented it. That's a ludicrous ask, Kelleher said. They are being unreasonable. Gorman, trying to calm everyone down, said they should all hope it might just be an opening salvo. They ask for the moon, and then maybe they get more reasonable. It was just past midnight, and courtroom 601 of the courthouse at 1 Bowling Green in Lower Manhattan was still packed with people standing shoulder to shoulder. The occasion was the approval of the sale of Lehman Brothers to Barclays by a bankruptcy judge. While the rest of the world had already moved on to the fates of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, 10,000 Lehman employees' jobs still lay in the balance. More than 150 lawyers, including some of the most prominent bankruptcy practitioners in the nation, were present on behalf of various creditors. Chelsea Clinton was in attendance, representing the hedge fund Avenue Capital. The proceedings had begun at 4:36 p.m., and Judge James Peck had insisted that he would reach a verdict before leaving for the night. The urgency of getting the sale approved was growing more and more evident, as with each passing hour, the markets chipped away at the value of Lehman's assets. Not only was the bankruptcy of Lehman, which had filed for Chapter 11 with $639 billion in assets, by far the largest in the nation's history, but an unwinding of so complex a financial institution had never before been attempted. On this late summer evening, the courtroom was on the warm side. The windows were closed, and, for lack of enough chairs, people had taken to sitting on the air vents. Lawyers from the firm representing Lehman, Weil Gotshal, carried in ice water. Signaling to Harvey Miller of Weil Gotshal, Judge Peck said, "You may approach, if that's what you're doing. I can't really tell. Frankly, with so many people in the courtroom, whenever I see the movement this way, I get a little concerned. Mr. Miller?" Miller, even under these circumstances, dapper in a gray suit, red tie, and blue shirt, outlined the deal. Barclays would pay $1.75 billion for Lehman's North American operations. "This is a tragedy, Your Honor," Miller said, of what had happened to Lehman Brothers. "And maybe we missed the RTC by a week," he added, referencing the development of the new TARP program. "That's the real tragedy, Your Honor." "That occurred to me as well," Judge Peck said sympathetically. Many of the lawyers for Lehman's creditors, however, were less charitable. They were furious about Lehman's deal with Barclays, suggesting it was paying far too little and complaining about ambiguities in the purchase agreement. Daniel H. Golden of Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld, representing an ad hoc group of investors holding more than $9 billion of Lehman bonds, pleaded with the court for a brief delay. "There has simply been no credible evidence adduced at this hearing that the price that Barclays is paying for these assets represents fair value," he said. "There's no other testimony or evidence that suggests the other assets being purchased by Barclays represent fair value or an attempt to maximize value for creditors." Miller, taking umbrage at the mere suggestion that the deal wasn't fair, shot back that the transaction had to be approved by the court immediately. "I don't want to use the melting ice cube analogy," he said, the emotion showing on his face, "but it's already half melted, Your Honor. The things that have happened since Wednesday make it imperative that this sale be approved. In the interest of all the stakeholders, including Mr. Golden's clients, they will benefit by this, Your Honor, because if the alternative happens, there will be very little to distribute to creditors, if anything." Nearly 8 hours and 3 recesses into the hearing, after arguments by dozens of lawyers, several interruptions because of static from the speakers, and one brief aside about Judge Wapner's The People's Court, Judge Peck, moved by the enormity of trying to save what was left of a more than century-old firm, agreed to sign off on the Barclays deal. "This is not simply approving the transaction because Mr. Miller is putting pressure on me to do so," the judge explained. "This is not approving the transaction because I know it's the best available transaction. I have to approve this transaction because it's the only available transaction." With a heavy heart, he went on to offer a eulogy. Lehman Brothers became a victim, in effect, the only true icon to fall in the tsunami that has befallen the credit markets. "And it saddens me. I feel that I have a responsibility to all the creditors, to all of the employees, to all of the customers, and to all of you." It was 12:41 a.m. when Judge Peck ended the hearing. As he stepped down from the bench, the courtroom, with at least several people moved to tears, erupted in a wave of applause. Tim Geithner hadn't slept well on Friday night, having decided to stay in one of the grim rooms on the 12th floor of the Federal Reserve. By 6 o'clock a.m., he had returned back upstairs to his office, dressed in an Oxford dress shirt and sweatpants, and began puttering around the hallways in his stocking feet. In his mind, he was already making battle plans. He had made it safely to the weekend, but he already was worried about what would happen on Monday if he didn't find a way to save Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. John's holding on to a slim reed, Paulson had told Geithner about John Mack's perilous position on a phone call the night before. They had heard that Morgan Stanley had only about $30 billion to $40 billion left, but Paulson was also still anxious about Goldman Sachs, his former employer. "We've got to find a lifeline for these guys," said Paulson, and they reviewed the possible options. On a pad that morning, Geithner started writing out various merger permutations. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup, Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley and Mitsubishi, Morgan Stanley and CIC, Morgan Stanley and Outside Investor, Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, Goldman Sachs and Wachovia, Goldman Sachs and Outside Investor, Fortress Goldman, Fortress Morgan Stanley. It was the ultimate Wall Street chessboard. Lloyd Blankfein arrived at his office at just past 7 o'clock on Saturday morning. Even though he was still pushing his Fortress Goldman bank holding plan, he and Gary Cohn had assigned more than a half dozen teams to start investigating different deals. HSBC, USB, Wells Fargo, Wachovia, Citigroup, Sumitomo, and Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. Cohn had had another conversation with Kevin Warsh of the Federal Reserve on Friday, who encouraged him to keep looking at merger options, especially at Citigroup. While it had never been made public, Goldman had explored the idea of merging with Citigroup several times over the past 18 months, but had never engaged in formal talks. Cohn and Warsh had discussed the possibility at least twice before, and even though Cohn always resisted the idea, he was intrigued. Initially, Cohn's notion was that Citi should buy Goldman. He had even established an asking price. But Warsh suggested that Cohn approach it the other way around. Goldman should be the buyer. To Cohn, that made no sense, given that Citi was so much bigger. But what Warsh knew, and hadn't yet shared with Cohn, was that Citigroup's balance sheet had so many holes that its value was likely a lot lower than its current stock price. As a result, the Fed was considering three possible outcomes for Citi, codenamed NewCo, Goldman Survivors, and Citi Survivors. Blankfein was reading an email when John Rogers, the firm's chief of staff, arrived. Blankfein pressed a secret button under his desk to open remotely the glass door to his office. Paulson had installed the Inspector Gadget-like device when he was Goldman's CEO. As he and Rogers were reviewing their own battle plans, Geithner called. In his usual impatient tone, he insisted that Blankfein immediately call Vikram Pandit, Citigroup's CEO, and begin merger discussions. Blankfein, slightly shocked at the directness of the request, agreed to place the call. "Well, I guess you know why I'm calling," Blankfein said when he reached Pandit a few minutes later. "No, I don't," Pandit replied with genuine puzzlement. There was an awkward pause on the phone. Blankfein had assumed that the Fed had prearranged the call. "Well, I'm calling you because at least some people in the world might be thinking that combining our firms would be a good idea," he said. After another few moments of uncomfortable silence, Pandit finally replied, "I want you to know I'm flattered by this call." Blankfein now began to wonder if Pandit was putting him on. "Well, Vikram," he said briskly, "I'm not calling with any flattery towards you in mind." Pandit hurriedly ended the call. "I'll have to talk to my board. I'll call you back." Blankfein hung up and looked up at Rogers. "Well, that was embarrassing. He had no idea what I was talking about." From Blankfein's perspective, he had done what he was asked to do, only to be shown up. Blankfein phoned Geithner back immediately. "I just called Vikram," he said testily. "As I think about it, you never told me whether Vikram was expecting a call, but I inferred it. He behaved as if he wasn't expecting the call, and he convinced me that he wasn't expecting the call." Geithner had miscalculated. Could Pandit not see the gift that was being handed to him? It defied all reason. But Geithner had no time to deal with anybody's injured feelings. "Okay, I'll talk to you later," he said, before hanging up. Blankfein sat there, wondering what the hell had just happened. Alan Greenspan and his wife, Andrea Mitchell, the NBC News journalist, were mingling in the crowd outside the Grand Ballroom at the St. Regis Aspen Resort on Saturday morning, the second day of Teddy Forsman's weekend conference. They were all waiting for the next panel to begin, entitled Crisis on Wall Street, What Next? By Wall Street standards, it was a star-studded event. The panelists included Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, Mohammed El-Erian, CEO of PIMCO, whose book When Markets Collide had just been published, CNBC's conservative talk show host Larry Kudlow, and perhaps the most intriguing, Bob Steele of Wachovia. Steele, who had considered canceling, had flown into Aspen that morning, leaving his home at 4 o'clock a.m. to arrive on time. By the time the moderator, Charlie Rose, got to the Q&A portion of the panel, however, Steele was nervously checking his watch. Greenspan had entered a debate about the controversies of mark-to-market accounting, but Steele knew he had to get back to the East Coast immediately. The moment the panel ended, he tried to bolt out of the room, but on the way out encountered Richard Kovacevic, the CEO of Wells Fargo, someone he thought could be a merger partner. "I was going to call you up next week," Steele told him. "Yes, I wanted to catch up." Kovacevic replied, "I'm running back to the airport. I'll call you," Steele promised. Jumping into a red Jeep Wrangler that he had rented at the airport, he finally had a minute to check his BlackBerry and discovered that Kevin Warsh had sent him several emails urging him to contact him immediately. "Listen, I have a call for you to make," Warsh told Steele when he finally reached him. "We think you should connect with Lloyd." Steele, reading between the lines, was stunned. The government was trying to orchestrate a merger between Goldman Sachs and Wachovia. On its face, he knew that it could be a politically explosive deal, considering the two firms' connections to Treasury. Paulson, he imagined, must be involved somehow. But of course, Paulson wasn't allowed to contact him directly. Steele was immediately anxious about the idea. If Goldman had really wanted to buy Wachovia, he thought, it would have done so long ago. After all, up until this week when he spoke to Mac, Goldman had been on Wachovia's payroll as its advisor, and as such knew every aspect of its internal numbers. So, if there was a bargain to be had, then Goldman hadn't seen it. Still, Steele saw the merits in such a deal, and if it was being encouraged by the Federal Reserve, he imagined it might just happen. "I spoke to Kevin, and he said to give you a call," Steele began when he got through to Blankfein. This call, unlike the Citibank fiasco, had been pre-wired. "Yes, I know," Blankfein said. "We'd be interested in putting a deal together." Steele told Blankfein he was about to step onto Wachovia's corporate jet and could be in New York by late that afternoon. As his plane headed for the East Coast, Steele mused how a deal with Goldman would be something of a homecoming, even if it had come as a direct order from the government. Perhaps he could even wangle the chairman title. Jamie Dimon had been hoping to be able to take his first day off in 2 weeks. That was until Geithner called him early Saturday morning and instructed him, the president of the New York Federal Reserve seldom suggested anything, to start thinking about whether he'd like to buy Morgan Stanley. "You've got to be kidding me," Dimon replied. "No," Geithner said, "he was quite serious." "I did Bear," Dimon objected, referring to buying Bear Stearns. "I can't do this." Geithner ignored his answer. "You'll be getting a call from John Mack," he said, and hung up the phone. Mack, who had had a similar peremptory call from Geithner, phoned Dimon 5 minutes later. Dimon reiterated that he didn't want to buy Morgan Stanley, which he had already told Mack earlier in the week. But Dimon was under orders to try to help Mack, so the two rivals talked about whether J.P. Morgan could offer Morgan Stanley a credit line that might give it some breathing room. Dimon said he'd think about it and get back to him with a decision. As soon as he got off the phone with Mac, Dimon called Geithner. "I talked to John," he said. "We're talking about getting him a credit line." "I don't know if that'll be enough," Geithner said, frustrated at the news. His order had not been explicit, but he hinted heavily that the Federal Reserve very much wanted the two firms to form a union, and wasn't the slightest bit interested in any temporary measures. Diamond immediately sent an email to his operating committee, summoning them to the office, and within an hour, dressed in golf shirts and khakis, they had assembled in a conference room on the 48th floor. Diamond had a grimace on his face as he related the call he'd received from Geithner, merging the houses of Morgan